Thank you, Dave. Well, I'm delighted to be with you this afternoon. That's really loud, isn't it? Am I loud? There's Kevin. He's going to rescue us. I'll let him do that so I'm not yelling at you. It is good to be with you today and see so many faces that I do know, some that I've been able to partner with and speak for. So trust that you are already having a great morning together. You really are the Green Beret of the pro-life movement, and I am grateful for the work that you do. Both my wife, Barb, and one of our daughters work in pregnancy care centers, and I know from their experiences both the joy as well as the heartache and even the discouragement that you face in your ministries. So this afternoon here, as we, it is afternoon, is it? Yes, this afternoon, as we focus on your work, I want to share a personal journey with you that my wife Barb and I have been on now for 16 years, and then share a few thoughts that I hope will encourage you and strengthen you as you press on in your work. So that's what I want to do here in our time together. Now, I don't expect to say anything that's particularly novel, which I know is exactly what you're not supposed to say as a guest speaker to your audience. But what I do want to do is I hope that our story will encourage you, inspire you, and remind you of some truths that you already know that maybe will be beneficial for you to be reminded of again. Barb and I, my wife and I, have 5 grown children, 4 daughters and 1 son. Our youngest daughter, Catherine, passed away very unexpectedly on July 19th, just a few months back, from a massive seizure. She died in her sleep. She was only 25 years old. And although God's mercy has been plentiful in our lives over these past few months, this has been very painful for us and for our other children as well. Barb and I adopted Catherine. This is a picture of her. This is an old picture of her. We adopted Catherine from Guatemala in 2006 when she was only 8 years old. And she had been born with cerebral palsy. She couldn't walk. She had very limited use of her hands, and she functioned mentally at about a 4-year-old level. Her short life was marked with pain and suffering. Now, we don't know a lot about her parents. We don't know if they ever married or not. We do know that shortly after Catherine was born, they separated. And when Catherine was about 2 years old, she was with her mom, but when she was about 2 years old, her father actually stole her away from the mother, and the mother had no idea. The mother's name was Brenda. Brenda was a very godly woman, very impoverished, but a very godly woman, and he had stolen her away. At 2 years of age, she had no idea where Catherine was at for 4 years. But when Catherine was 6 years old, she was abandoned on the streets of Guatemala City at 6 years old at 6 o'clock in the morning. She was left with a small suitcase, no wheelchair, just left there on the corner. A security guard found her, took her into the business that he was guarding. They called the police. The police came and got her. She stayed in that police department until 10 o'clock at night because they couldn't find an orphanage that was able to take her because of her needs. They finally did, and she spent 3 years in that orphanage. But what happened was really kind of fascinating. Catherine had only been in the orphanage for a couple of weeks, and the orphanage director took her to a physical therapist, just kind of for an appointment, you know, a checkup or whatever. And when they walked in with Catherine, the receptionist said, "Catherine, what are you doing here?" They knew her, because it turned out that her father had taken her there at least a couple of times. Through that, they were able to reconnect Catherine with her biological mother, which was beautiful. However, her mother, Brenda, was unable to parent her because she was very impoverished, but she also had severe epilepsy. And so she knew she couldn't care for Catherine, so she placed her for adoption. When she went to the court to sign off parental rights, the judge wanted to be sure that she knew what she was doing. And so he said, "Now you realize, Brenda, that if you sign off, she's liable to be adopted by somebody in the United States and you're likely never to see her again." And she said, "I know, but I want what's best for her." And so she did place her for adoption. We had the opportunity, it was a great privilege to meet her biological mother. Again, she was very sweet. It was heartbreaking, but it was wonderful. A couple more quick photos. This is, I know some of you can't see this, I'm sorry, but this is a picture of Catherine with her biological mother. And then this is a picture here of Barb and I when we first met her in Guatemala, brought her home a year and a half later. And then this is a picture of our whole family. minus 10 grandkids and some sons-in-laws and so forth. But despite Catherine's suffering, she was almost always joyful. She had a smile the size of Texas. She was tender-hearted, very affectionate, extremely accepting of others, very forgiving of others. And yet she was at the same time a real character. And she provided endless entertainment for our family. She loved jewelry, the gaudier the better. She had a savant ability to remember birthdays. She couldn't remember what she had for lunch today, but she could remember birthdays. And so if you gave her her birthday today and asked her a year later when your birthday was, she would know it, okay? She loved to sing, but she seldom knew the words to the songs. Her voice was horrible, and on top of that. And so, to give you an example, Elton John's song, Benny and the Jets, she thought the words were Betty and the Gents. And we never told her the truth because we liked that version better, but she knew nothing of politics, as you could imagine. In 2016, during the after the presidential election, when Donald Trump was elected president, we lived at that time in Salina, Ohio, a small town, but they had a very stately courthouse just a block or two from our home. And one day I was driving Catherine to school in the morning, and we went by the courthouse, and I said to her, I was just trying to make conversation with her, I said, Catherine, do you know what that building is? Now, it looks like a miniature version of the White House. It's very stately, big stone pillars and so forth. I said, do you know what that building is? She said, the White House. And I said, no, it looks like the White House. It's actually the courthouse, but I can see why you said that. So that was the end of the conversation. About a month later, I'm bringing her back home from school one day, and we go by it again, and I thought, I'm going to see if she remembers this. So I said, Catherine, do you know what that building is? And she said, the White House. She said it again, the White House. So I went with her, and I said, yes, and do you know who lives there? Now, remember, this was right after the 2016 very heated presidential election. I asked her, do you know who lives there? Her response, Donald Trump and his wife, Hillary. So she was a never-ending supply of great and rich entertainment in our home. Now, adopting Catherine was both the fulfillment of a dream and the fulfillment, or I should say, the answer to prayer. But it did set us on a difficult journey. For many years, we had wanted to adopt. We had tried to adopt. I had been pastoring church at that time in Fort Wayne, and we had pursued a couple of different adoptions, and both of those fell through. And then the long story short is I was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer in 01. So that, in our minds, that was the end of our dream to adopt. And so we put that to rest. But 5 years later, I was on the way home from the University of Chicago, just having gotten my 5-year checkup and calling me, you know, free of cancer, you know, a cure, whatever. And I get a phone call from a friend of ours who ran a ministry in third world countries to find Christian homes for hard to place children. And he called me and said, "Do you guys still want to adopt?" And I said, "I don't know. I think so. I mean, we laid that to rest." And I said, "Well, let me call Barb." So he told me in that conversation that he was looking for homes for 3 children, and one of them was Catherine. And so I called Barb, and she said, "Yes." Well, again, I'm cutting a lot on this story, but that's how this all came about. That's how Catherine ended up in our home. And so after a year and a half of working through the adoption process, Catherine entered our lives like a 45-pound human tornado. She had little discipline, no schooling. And to our surprise, this strong-willed little orphan suffered from an acute sense of entitlement. On top of this, she spoke only Spanish and we spoke only English. And so suffice it to say, we were woefully unprepared for the challenges that were ahead of us there. Now, we adopted Catherine of a deep conviction that every human being matters at every stage of development, and that every human being should be loved and cherished and in a family. And so that was our motive. But we admitted we had a very Pollyanna-ish kind of view of adoption. And we thought we were rescuing a child from an orphanage. What we didn't know was that God was going to use Catherine to rescue us from our selfishness. Not that we had been completely rescued. Okay? Through her, God had provided a very painful window into our own souls. Her many needs posed a threat to our independence and had launched us, launched a full frontal assault, frankly, on our selfishness. And we found ourselves at war with our own flesh for quite some time. Placing Catherine's many needs above our own became a daily challenge, and we often wrestled with feelings of resentment and anger over the loss of many of our freedoms. Now, Catherine, of course, was facing challenges of her own. having been yanked from the only world that she knew, and now facing a language barrier that prevented her from being able to communicate the things that she needed to communicate. Although she learned Spanish much faster than we learned, or I'm sorry, she learned English much faster than we learned Spanish, I can assure you of that. Because of her physical and mental limitations, Catherine suffered in many other ways as well. She was confined to a wheelchair. She watched a good deal of her life, her childhood, pass by her. She desperately wanted to do the things that other children did, like ride a bike and play on a trampoline and so forth, and she could never do any of those things. But to her credit, she always took great delight in watching other children do those things. Later, as a young adult, Catherine, like all young adults, wanted her independence and wanted her freedom, but didn't have the cognitive abilities or the physical abilities to fulfill that dream in her life. It grieved her deeply, and yet she came to accept that as well. Now, through the 16 years that we had Catherine, occasionally we would hear people say to us, "Wow, that is really great of you guys that you adopted somebody with special needs." And I suppose there's some truth in that, but there was something that they didn't know. And that was that although we knew of Catherine's physical limitations, we had no idea that she had been diagnosed severely mentally handicapped. This detail had been hidden from us by the orphanage. And I confess that had we known, we would not have adopted her. In our minds, that would have been a bridge too far in our thinking. And I must also confess that we found ourselves resentful of the orphanage director, and at times resentful of Catherine too, although none of this was her fault. Caring for Catherine was incredibly inconvenient. She needed to be wheeled everywhere or carried everywhere, which posed greater challenges as she grew older. She was unable to do menial tasks like cut her own food, you know, zip up her coat, care for herself in the bathroom, these things. Her mental disability posed even greater challenges for us. Although there was a humorous side to this, as I've already communicated, this could be very taxing and annoying. She could ask the same question ad nauseum. And at times, she was ungrateful, oftentimes ungrateful. Barb, my wife, was her personal slave most of the time, and yet she had the audacity one day to say to her, "You only care about yourself." We still laugh about that. Raising our other children, quite frankly, our other four children, was a breeze compared to raising Catherine. Now, I'm not proud of this, but in those early years, there were times when we regretted our decision to adopt her. When we asked ourselves, what were we thinking? How could God have allowed things to be so difficult when we were trying to do something so good? Catherine was not what we had bargained for. And yet, Catherine was exactly what God wanted for us. And we know that. And he certainly knew that. Our Heavenly Father knows what we need before we ask. Jesus tells us that right in the Gospels. But he also knows when we don't know what to ask, what it is that we need, or when we ask for the wrong thing, which is exactly what we were doing when we were praying about adoption. Though we oftentimes struggled to accept the challenges that came with raising a child with multiple disabilities, we came to realize that Catherine was God's sanctification plan for our lives, that she needed us, but we desperately needed her as well. We look back now and we marvel over God's goodness in allowing us to be her parents. And I will tell you, as a father, it is one of the greatest privileges of my life that I got to parent Catherine, that I got to be her dad. James chapter 1, verse 17 says that every good and perfect gift comes from above, from the Father of heavenly lights. Indeed, Catherine was God's good and perfect gift to us. So what I would like to do here for the remainder of my time with you is talk a little bit about the challenges that you face and the sanctification process that God might be working in you through your ministries, and maybe in other ways, through your own family lives, whatever. I know that most of your clients who walk into your center and into your lives are there because of sin, because of bad decisions, and they bring a lot of baggage with them. Their lives are a mess. Their relationships, in many cases, are a mess. Their value systems, I'm sure, in many cases, are a mess. And I know that your work is not without discouragement and not without disappointment. And maybe it's even disillusioning at times for you. The heartache of pouring into a young mom who's abortion-minded, thinking you're making progress only to have her walk out that door and head down to Planned Parenthood. The disappointment or the frustration of helping those who are entitled and are ungrateful for the help that you provide, or maybe you have the responsibility of keeping the bills paid and the lights on and so forth. I'm sure there are plenty of other challenges that you face. Now, although I did not work in a pregnancy care center, I served as a pastor for 23 years, and I certainly understand the burden of ministry and the temptation to become hardened or jaded by it. I mean, none of us is immune to that, right? It's easy to begin to see, I'm not saying that you do this, but it is easy to begin to see those that you're ministering to as a problem. I don't know what's going on here. Is this my microphone? You're hearing that, right?
Yeah. Just a little closer to your mouth.
Maybe. I don't think that's it.
Okay.
I think there's something.
Oh, there is static. Okay.
Well, I don't know what to do about that. I know that pro-life ministry isn't as glamorous as some maybe think it is. It's messy because you're in the broken people business. And that's what you do, right? And again, most of the clients coming to you are coming to you with challenges. Again, I worked in pastoral roles for many years, and I know how difficult these ministries can be. And this is why, really, fruitful ministry has to begin with your own funeral. Paul said that, didn't he? He said, I die daily. And Jesus said, if anyone wants to be my disciple, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Every human being is precious. I'm not going to sermonize you on that or lecture you. I know that you know that. But convincing ourselves sometimes of that truth is a challenge, isn't it? It's a process. Loving the least of these can't just include the cuddly little ones. Sometimes it includes the cranky, crusty ones. 1 Peter says that it was not with perishable things such as silver or gold that we were redeemed from the empty way of life, but rather by the precious blood of the Lamb, of Jesus. He died for all of us, not just those in this room, but your clients and those that are difficult sometimes to love. Broken people need us, and we need them too. We are each a part of God's plan to sanctify and to mature one another. And although sometimes it appears otherwise, we need difficult people in our lives. It's not just that we need others when they're needy. We need the neediness of others, because God uses that neediness to perfect us, to mature us, to grow us. We were created to give ourselves away. Whether that's the child diagnosed with cerebral palsy or the client who comes to you with all kinds of challenges. But this is the power of the gospel in a believer's life, to be able to see God's divine reflection both in every human being, both in the preborn and in the born, and to reach beyond our selfish hearts to find the love and the courage to love those who can be unlovely. You know that this is true in any ministry, in any business. There are all kinds of people in their jobs who don't do their jobs very well. Some doctors don't care about their patients. Some attorneys don't care about their clients. Some school teachers don't care about their students. None of us are immune to seeing human beings as a problem instead of seeing them as sacred fellow image bearers. And I want to encourage you with that. The surprising gift of the gospel is the discovery that real life is found in giving ourselves away. The splendor of the incarnation is found in the fact that God became flesh and entered our pain and our suffering. That God made him who knew no sin to be sin for us so that we might become the righteousness of God. If we will embrace the pain of ministry and the difficulty and the heartache and the disappointment of ministry, God will use that to grow us, to mature us, to conform us to the likeness of his Son, Jesus. But if we resent those that we minister to, if we become hardened or jaded, if we allow the hurts and the pains of ministry to fester, we will adopt a victim mentality which will harden us over time, robbing us of our joy and rendering us ineffectual in our efforts. At Catherine's funeral, my wife said something that has stayed with me, and this is what she said. She said, through the years of having Catherine in our home, I've learned that there's no joy apart from submitting to his will. And that is so true, isn't it? As enjoyable and fulfilling as pro-life ministry can be, it's not without pain or sacrifice. It is messy. Just as Catherine was God's sanctification plan for our lives, your clients, and your fellow workers, and I don't want to cause any trouble here today, your fellow workers sometimes are your sanctification plan, God's sanctification plan for you. But we can trust that God knows what is best for us, even when the path that we're on is scary, or difficult, or uncertain. I want to close with a very short story. It's a story that most of you know the first part of it, but I'm guessing most of you don't know the second part of it. And it's the story, the gospel-saturated story of Casper Ten Boom. By the way, this is Catherine, more recent of Catherine. And then this last photo, this is Casper Ten Boom. I'm sure you know him as Corrie Ten Boom's father, the Dutch watchmaker, very humble and godly Christian man. And his name has become synonymous with love, courage, and sacrifice today. And he had turned his home, which was two stories above his watchmaker shop, he was a watchmaker, in Holland during the Nazi occupation of the Netherlands. He had turned his home into a hiding place. He and his adult children, Corrie, Betsy, and Willem, had taken one of the bedrooms on the third floor, and they had come out from one of the walls and built in another wall with a pantry and a hiding place, a little cavity there, that they were harboring six adult Jewish people in their home. And they had hooked up a little buzzer downstairs in the watchmaker shop under the counter so that if the Nazis or anybody came in, it was questionable, they could discreetly reach under, hit the buzzer, and ring a bell upstairs, and the Jews could go into hiding. Well, they did this for about 7 or 8 months. They got away with this, but somebody finally ratted them out. And so the Gestapo showed up in force and raided the home, turned the place upside down and inside out, could not find the Jews. They were so well hidden. But they did cart Casper and his adult children off to the Schwedenburg prison camp. Now, this is the part two of the story that I'm guessing most of you don't know. But it's a beautiful story. And by the way, it's in my book, so you might want to grab my book on the way out. Years later, after reflecting on that first night when they had been taken to the Schwedenburg prison camp, by the way, it wasn't just his adult children, but his grandson Peter had also been arrested with them. And Peter recounts the story of that night. And listen to this. The emotional agony of that moment and his grandfather's last words. Just one paragraph. Here's what he writes. Where were the host of angels that we had prayed for so often? Had God forgotten us? Then I glanced over at grandfather sitting in the corner. There was such an expression of peace on his pale face that I could not help but marvel. He actually was protected. God had built a fence around him. Suddenly I knew. The everlasting arms are all around all of us. God does not make mistakes. He is at the controls. At last, they took me to my cell. As I walked past grandfather, I stopped, bent over him, and kissed him goodbye. He looked up at me and said, "My boy, are we not a privileged generation?" Those were his last words to me. Is that not a beautiful story? We have a duty to love our neighbor. We have a duty to love the preborn and their moms and their dads. But more than that, we have the grand privilege of serving them. You know, I'm a pastor at heart. I've been a pastor for 13 years. But I love pastors, and I thank God for pastors who are faithful. But the vast majority have gone silent. And that frustrates me, just like it frustrates you. But more than angering me or frustrating me, I feel sorry for them. They don't know what they're missing. Jesus said, what you do for the least of these, you do for me. What a privilege that we get to serve in this way. We're not victims, we're not martyrs, and nobody has to feel sorry for us. Our preborn neighbors are worthy of a robust defense. Their mothers and their fathers desperately need our love, and we are richly blessed to be able to provide it at whatever price we pay for the grand privilege of rescuing little ones and their families from abortion will certainly prove trivial when that final veil is lifted, and we hear those words, "Well done, thy good and faithful servant." God bless you.
Again, appreciate Mike being willing to share his book with everybody, and don't forget to get a copy as you leave today. I have just a few announcements, and then we'll let you go to the, we'll have some brief, kind of a half hour, maybe 25 minutes break where you can spend some time with the vendors or network some more. If you haven't gotten on the networking app yet and would like a little bit of help, Lucas Fonseca, Language Matters, is right over here at this first vendor table, and he can get you set up within a minute. And I think is that active for another couple of weeks?
A month.
A month. So you'll still be able to connect with some of those that are on that app. Tara, I think, is going to announce the last door prize.
Yeah. Okay, so the $100 Jimmy John's gift card goes to First Choice for Women.
Okay. We realized just this networking time, that last time you had where you were networking with other people in your position, that we didn't provide evaluations. And we wanted to make sure that we get that done. So we'll send out a Google form sometime next week with the networking groups information and some questions just to get some feedback on what you liked or didn't like. And as I'm saying that, also, I wanted to thank a Hope Center out of Fort Wayne, which helped with the facilitating of the networking time. I noticed we had their names down, but didn't say what organization they were with. So wanted to make sure we identified them. Don't forget the appreciation booklet out here in the main area. Make sure you write a note to our anonymous donors. And unfortunately, we have to reset this space right after you all leave to go to the next workshop, which means you'll need to take your items with you. Unless you have credit cards you want to leave, then I can take 3 months. One other thing. I host a medical services Zoom call every quarter. And if you're not already involved in that, we would love to have you join us for that. It gives especially nurses an opportunity to share what's going on in their center and ask questions of other nurses. So if you're interested in that, please see me before the end of the day, or you could always email us at info@nci4life.org. Tara, I don't know if Tara's out here or not, if we've got anything else that I think I've covered it all. This is the last time we'll be here as a group, and I just want to thank all of you again for everything that you do, and just really appreciate it. We spent a lot of time getting ready for this event, and to be honest, it's one of our favorite of the year. And so for you guys to show up, and I just hope you're getting as much out of this as we get by putting it on to you and for you. And that's all I have to say. So thank you.